Really happy to have you with us on this New Year's Day. Larry Mueller here. Happy New Year, everybody. And really happy to have a couple of guests who come by on most every holiday. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. One of our guests, Noel, hi.
Happy New Year, Larry, and to all of our listeners out there this morning.
To you as well. And also with us, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources. He works out of Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. And Bill, Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you, Larry, and as well to you and everyone else out there.
Well, I tell you what, I know we're going to have lots of calls today, as we do on every holiday when you guys are with us. And really appreciate having you here again on this New Year's Day. Let me give the number to call. If you'd like to join us with a question or comment about birds here, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'll be glad to get you on the air. Noel, anything unusual in the way of sightings this time of year for you?
Well, I was out early this morning to start the New Year bird, or New Year ride by looking at birds, and we were out before dawn, and we were able to hear some owls calling. And we went to the Port Washington Harbor and saw a nice little variety of waterfowl. And so it was a nice way to start out the day. I think one of the biggest excitements earlier in the winter was a nice influx of young snowy owls coming down from the Arctic.
Yeah.
But those have kind of tapered off, and we're not seeing too many now, even though there's one being seen at the Coast Guard Impoundment in Milwaukee, and there's a few others around. And the other species is probably the white-winged crossbill. This is a northern finch that comes down in certain years, and this year appears to be a good year for white-winged crossbills. And if you have any white spruce around, especially white spruce with cones on, keep an eye out for those, because we've been seeing them all throughout Wisconsin over the last several weeks.
Super. And Bill, what about you?
Well, I came into the office this morning, so I'm staring out over at Horican Marsh from my office window. It's a little still on the marsh, but along the roadside, a large flock of snow buntings took off, and that was nice to see, a good way to start off the new year. And as I got this morning, of course, the usual feeder birds were out there.
Yep.
So it is a quieter time, but it doesn't mean that we're devoid of birds. There's some good stuff to see out there at this time. And as Noel had mentioned, every few years there's a couple of interesting surprises that seem to erupt a little bit. And it's always that randomness among some of those birds, I think, that keep it exciting.
Well, we have many callers online to visit with you. Let's go to Colleen in Ridgeway right off the bat here. Colleen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is this. I have a small bluebird trail of 18 houses. I raised 44 babies last summer, and four bluebirds, three males and a female, stayed. So they've been here all winter. This is the third winter in a row I've had bluebirds. And this morning, I noticed at the bird bath there was a fifth bluebird. Another male has joined them. My question to you is, what do I feed them? I have bittersweet everywhere on the railings, and they love that. In fact, I have quite a few vines that I bring in from the woods, and they've pretty much eaten all of the seeds. But I've tried mealyworms, and, of course, I live on the ridge, so they blew right out of the dish. That doesn't work. But I'm wondering if there's something else I can entertain them with besides the berries they're finding out in the woods.
Noel, we'll turn to you first.
Well, my first suggestion is something you've already mentioned, Colleen, and that is bittersweet. I think that is, in my opinion, probably the finest food for bluebirds this time of year in Wisconsin. As you mentioned, we always have a few stick around. It seems like we're seeing a few more stay in the winter here in recent years, but this time of year, typically they're feeding almost entirely on berries. So I think bittersweet is really a fine one. Some people will put out, you know, raisins or something like that, but of course it's like mealworms. They're probably going to blow right away, or if you can find some secluded place to put some fruit. You know, they occasionally feed on small crab apples or even though it's an invasive multiflora rose.
Yes, we have that out in the hay field and so forth. So
it sounds like you're doing the right thing.
I would love to keep them for the winter. So
well, do your best. Do your best. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Happy New Year. Mike in Castle Rock, we turn to you next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
We've had a northern shrike at the feeder, And yesterday, down by the creek, there was a killdeer, and my neighbor has a female towhee at her feeder. So that's the report from Grant County. Anyway.
That's the report from Grant County. Bill?
Well, you've got a couple of unusual ones there. As we heard earlier, the bluebirds and robins, these are birds we don't normally think of as winter birds. And we do see some of them sticking around, especially when you do a bit of a survey, especially across all of southern Wisconsin. Your killdeer is very unusual, very peculiar that that would stick around. And also, if you've got areas with open water, particularly spring-fed little creeks, snipe sometimes stick around through the winter. Even Virginia rail will stay late into the season. Some may try to make it through. Even great blue herons, if there's that little bit of open water, and even kingfishers. The towhee, this is another bird that normally is not found this far north, but there's always that exception of one or two birds that may end up here. And we don't really know if there's some sort of a physiological failure for them to get into migration mode, that they're not leaving, or if they're in poor condition, that they're not able to go, or for some odd reason, just the roll of the dice that one out of every 100,000 decides just not to go. But that's what keeps some of this interesting, is when you have enough eyes out there, there's always a few surprises among it, and you've got some good ones, definitely.
Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. George in Madison, we're on to you next. George, hello.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
One of the things I've been reading about is there are at least one and maybe more proposals to put wind farms literally right on the Lake Michigan shoreline. What concerns are there and about this type of land use and what impact it could have on migratory birds of all types?
All right. Well, maybe both of our guests. Noel, well, let's start with you.
Yeah, thanks for asking about wind. It's certainly a topic today that we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the years to come. And there's a number of new farms that have just been constructed in this past year and gone into operation. There's others being constructed and others still in the planning phases. And you mentioned Lake Michigan. One of the areas that people are looking at is actually putting them offshore. I haven't heard of really any serious proposals for right on the lakeshore area. I think that probably would not be the best place to site them, and I would guess that there's some agencies and other folks that might have some problems with locating them real close to the lakeshore. But I think in years to come, as some of the better locations in Wisconsin have windmills constructed and operating, we're going to see more interest in offshore. That's where the good wind resources are. There's no question that winds are stronger and more consistent out over Lake Michigan, but, of course, that does raise a lot of other questions. One of the things I'm starting to investigate now is to look at how do we go about studying bird life and bird movements in offshore areas to try to come up with an idea of how much risk it would put to birds that migrate over the water, especially some of the lower flying birds like the loons and grebes and the waterfowl and cormorants and pelicans. Of course, a lot of our nocturnal migrants are going to be flying probably, for the most part, pass over top of the windmills, but those that are flying closer to the surface of the water, we really need to get a better handle on what the risk might be to these birds. So it's an area that's really being studied a lot in Wisconsin. There's a lot of people going out and doing point counts and searching beneath wind turbines to see the numbers and kinds of birds and bats that are being killed by wind turbines, and you're going to see a lot of interest in this over the next several years throughout the state.
Yeah, Bill, anything to add there?
Well, we've mentioned before that there's a concern overall over what we call the tall structures. Anything big that we put up there, skyscrapers, communication towers, so forth, these are all at least potential obstacles that birds have to negotiate with. And with this rapid development of wind farms across North America and as Europe as well, one of the problems is that the structures we see today, some of these things 400 feet in height or more, are certainly not the little windmills that were out on the farms in the past. And these things are going up so fast that we have no ability to be able to really understand where are areas of high risk to avoid in advance. Most of the studies that are being done are after the fact. And so there's at least a potential risk, and I think we're really uncertain at this point what sort of additional obstacles we're creating, One thing is for sure, that where the winds are good oftentimes is not only where the wind generators go, but these are traditionally the migratory pathways, particularly for raptors, birds that tend to soar rather than fly. And the other problem is that we've seen this with communication towers, is you can have some of these things up for years or even decades with very little mortality, but it's episodic, that every so often over so much time, you've got the right weather conditions, heavy overcast skies, birds are flying low, and all of a sudden you're going to have a very high mortality. If it is, should be, you know, that certain areas are more hot spots than others, I don't think that we have enough of an understanding of migratory pathways and behavior of birds to really put these things where they minimize risk. Right now they're just sort of randomly going up wherever there's good wind, and then we study it after the fact. I think the jury's quite out as to what the overall impact will be, but you know, birds are under a lot of stresses in a lot of ways. We're just adding another one with a variety of tall structures, including our digital TV.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that call, George. Appreciate it. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests, as we talk birds with them, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Some open lines on this New Year's Day. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Jim in Irma next. Jim, hello to you.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Just a couple of sightings. One of them was actually a sighting. I was walking across a field on Madeline Island during deer season, walking back to the camper, and I found on a little, about a waist-high alder bush, in a fork of it, a mouse hung by his neck, kind of impaled on this fork, which I assumed was a shrike, you know, leaving his food there. And then just last Sunday, we were watching, I came in the house to warm up and watch the Packer game for a few minutes, and I was looking at the bird feeder, and there was a northern shrike sitting on the lower part of our bird feeder stick, and it nailed a vole while I was watching it. Jumped on the snow, grabbed his vole, pulled him up, whacked him about four times on his head, and flew off with his lunch. Pretty cool.
That's a pretty cool sight, isn't it, Noel?
Yes, well, it is, and it's always a pleasure. I like to see shrikes. This year we have, I guess, a moderate number of shrikes in the state. Last year was a wonderful, wonderful year for shrikes. I think one of the best years we've had. This we have two species of shrike that visit Wisconsin. We have the loggerhead shrike, which is now an endangered species in the state because of how their populations have declined. They're more of a southern species. Now we only get maybe two or three breeding pairs that we find out about each year. But then every winter we have a few of the larger northern shrike coming down that breed farther to the north, and as Jim mentioned, they love to feed on small mammals, and if they are already full and they get another mouse or a vole, they'll, as he points out, lodge it on into a shrub or some kind of woody structure, or maybe impale it on a hawthorn thorn, or maybe even on a barbed wire fence if one is handy. So they're always looking out for when times are tough. If they have a few of these prey items stashed around, they can find them during really poor inclement weather.
One thing I found interesting was how could they remember where they put it? I was walking in a field, it was probably a 14-acre field. The bush wasn't any higher than my waist, and here was this little teeny mouse, and I got to looking around. I mean, I can see where he hung it there, but how could he remember days later where it actually hung?
Wow.
But that's pretty interesting.
Now, shrikes set up winter territories, just like most of our breeding birds set up territories that they defend during the breeding season. Northern shrikes set up winter territories, and they become very familiar with that area, and I'm sure that they remember somehow where those items are stashed.
And they probably don't always remember.
Well, I would also add that, you know, most of our predators are, while we think of them very efficient in terms of their adaptations, the claws, beaks, and so forth that they have, and of course shrikes lack the real claws for grabbing and killing, which is why they impale their prey. But overall, for the number of attempts they make to get their prey, there's a lot of times they strike out. So when you finally do get a meal like that, one way or another, I don't think you're going to forget about it that easily, because it's easier to find that meal again and go back a few days later than it is to try to hunt and hope you're going to catch another one.
All right. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests today. Noel of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the DNR, stationed at Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Area. If you have a question for them, I hope you'll join in as we talk resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Rob Ferret, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And again, if you'd like to join in our conversation, I hope you'll call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk birds. Maybe you've had an interesting sighting, or maybe you've seen something you don't quite know what it is, or other questions relating to migration or our resident birds, feel free to join us at talk@wpr.org. That's our email. And again, our 800 number is 1-800-642-1234. Join in and we'll be glad to have you on the air. I had an experience this morning. We heard a bang and looked outside, and there was a hawk in our tree looking down at our feeder. And I don't know if the hawk hit the window or if it was a bird trying to get away from the hawk. And it was a little dark. I couldn't make out which hawk I had out there.
You're starting out the new year right, huh?
Yeah, I couldn't. I thought I got the binoculars out. It was just a little bit too dark to see which hawk. Well, but there aren't too many options.
Yeah, Cooper's hawk is probably your most likely option. You know, the populations of Cooper's hawks have really rebounded nicely from the pesticide era. And Cooper's hawks have learned, at least some of them have anyway, that if they just make a pass at a bird feeder or fly in, the other birds will kind of flush in a panic, and they don't really choose the where they should be flying, and sometimes they'll encounter a window, and they will learn to pick up a stunned bird or a bird that's been killed by a window off a front porch or down in the shrubbery, whatever it might be. So they use that as a hunting strategy now of flushing the birds and letting the windows do their deed for them.
Oh, man. Bill, you were going to make a comment, too?
Well, that was going to be my guess. It'd be Cooper's hawk is the most likely, and we've talked about in the past that the hawks, such as Cooper's hawk, goshawk, sharpshin, with those short, rounded wings and long tails, they are the ones that will run down birds for their prey, where the larger, bulkier hawks, like the red tail, tend to pounce on prey, and that's more often the rodents, small rabbits, and things like that. Doesn't mean that red tails won't take birds if they have a chance, but they're, in a sense, they're a little too large and clumsy usually to be able to take them. But that's the primary food for Coopers and sharpshinned. And bird feeders end up being a pretty popular spot. And I get calls quite often where people are concerned about Cooper's hawks at the feeder. And, of course, it's a two-stage feeding process, as I consider it. You put out the seed, brings in the songbirds, now you bait it into birds of prey. And a couple of things for people to keep in mind. Either you can simply appreciate that you have a bird of prey there, realize they've always been part of that ecosystem. They're not decimating all the birds. They're oftentimes getting the vulnerable ones. It's oftentimes heartbreaking, too, when they take your favorite cardinal right off the feeder. But the other thing to do is you can just shut down your feeder for, say, a week or 10 days, and as the songbirds disperse and as the hawks' luck runs out, they'll disperse as well.
Well, we have four feeders out in our backyard, so we've got a menagerie of birds out there.
I'd imagine. And the questions of hawks at bird feeders, I get calls on it all the time, and whether it's astonishment, curiosity, or if it's shock and horror, it's kind of all of them, depending on people's experiences.
You know, the last time you guys were on, we were talking about eagles, and eagles after coots on open water. You may or may not remember that.
Oh, sure.
But I went home, and I think it was like a day or two later that I saw an eagle on Lake Monona dive bombing a flock of coots. And he'd go, and the coots would go under, and they'd come back up again, and then he'd swing around. Unfortunately, I had to leave, and my wife said, "Why didn't you video that?" And I said, "I don't know. I was I wasn't thinking, because it was right in front of our house. It would have been a great thing to have had on video."
Well, as we've mentioned too, eagles are not that efficient of taking birds, though they will occasionally get them off the water. But for something like coots, they're not that effective of a diver. It is a strategy. But what they'll do with that repeated swooping is just tire them out. They just can't hold their breath anymore, can't get under, and they'll do that time and again. And when they finally poop out, they'll take something that's vulnerable. And that's another strategy that works for them.
Yeah. Dave in Monona is up next. Dave, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Happy New Year, Larry. I love these guests, and I love this program that you do.
Thank you.
Hey, I was up in Ely, Minnesota, a month and a half ago or so, and a varied thrush turned up at one of the feeders. And I just wanted to relay that to your guests. It was pretty exciting. My understanding is it's a western bird. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Larry, or Dave, I'm sorry. We get a few reports every winter of varied thrushes. I think I've only seen maybe one so far this in December, but I would expect we'll start getting a few reports now that the Christmas count season is going on. And in February, we have the great backyard bird count, and it seems like a few people always find a varied thrush or two coming into feeders. But, yes, it is a thrush species from the Pacific Northwest. But every winter, we have a few, usually males, but occasionally a female. But they'll find its way into Wisconsin, and they seem to be pretty successful because they find a feeder, and they'll feed on cracked corn or a variety of other food. So their diet is varied enough that you can usually find enough, I think, to make it through the winter.
They're also one of those few western birds that do not make a normal north-south migration for the entire flock. So Bohemian waxwings will occasionally migrate this way. Also, the solitaire will come into Wisconsin. So there are a few of these that will make a bit of an east-west migration.
Oh.
I see. Hey, one other quick thing. In my yard here in Monona, when I had my trees trimmed, I left one large branch cut off dead because I thought, well, I want to see if woodpeckers come. We got red-bellied woodpeckers right away, and I just think if we could urge folks around these suburbs to leave one kind of large dead branch in a tree rather than trimming it up, we might see a few more woodpeckers. So
very good idea.
Very
you betcha. One of the problems that we find is that those dead trees make some good firewood for people. They're also homes for a lot of the cavity nesting birds and what we call secondary cavity nesters. So, say, like tree swallows, they don't make their own cavities, but they rely on those that are left over, or, of course, they'll take for the birdhouses. And, a single large branch like that, or even selective harvest within a forest or woodlot where you want to leave a few of those trees out there. They're very important feeding sites for the insects that are there and, of course, the nesting sites.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I even have a few people that have transported snags into their yard if they don't have them. If you can get a 10-foot piece on a trailer or in the back of your Suburban or something and transport it and prop it up in your yard or actually use a posthole digger and bury it and create your own snag in your yard if you can.
Good ideas. Mike in Rice Lake, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, guys. Just wanted to relate an amazing coincidence. I was listening to the show, watching the birds at our feeder. We live north of Rice Lake. And for 14 years here, all of a sudden a junco hit the patio door and was laying there flirting, and boom, another bird grabbed it and went out in the lawn about 10 feet. And I couldn't see the bird right away. And then I went and looked, and I got a little glimpse of it, and it flew off with a blue jay chasing it. And I'd never seen this bird before, and so I started looking through the hawk section, couldn't find it, and in the background I heard you guys mention shrike. I opened the page to shrike, and here's a shrike, and I haven't seen one in 14 years, and just as you guys are talking about when one takes a bird from my feeder.
Oh, that's a...
What a coincidence, huh?
We talked about eagles and coot, now shrikes and feeders. What else should we talk about today, right?
I don't know.
Is it just the northern one that takes small birds, or is it or the, would the loggerhead do? I didn't get a real good look at it, so I don't
both
know which
of them will have a similar diet, but as Noel mentioned earlier, the loggerhead shrike, we're at the far northern edge of its range. The populations have been declining and now listed as endangered. It is normally not a winter bird here to begin with, and the populations are really quite sparse within Wisconsin. This time of year, we're getting a good influx of the northern shrikes, and so that's certainly the bird to be expected.
Must have been a real pretty bird. Yeah.
And notice, as we said earlier, they'll impale the prey because they do not have talons for holding that prey in place. And that's why they'll either wedge it in the little fork of a tree or on thorns or even barbed wire. They'll hook it because essentially this is a predatory bird of prey. It's a songbird.
Yeah.
But it's got that big, sharp, hooked bill for tearing its flesh. So a very odd kind of adaptation among a songbird to become predatory on other songbirds and small voles and rodents.
All right, thanks. Great show, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Al in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Al.
Yes, I had a couple questions. I live on the in Milwaukee on 11th floor, and would birds come up to that, for a bird feeder?
Oh, okay. So you're on the 11th floor, probably a little patio out there, and would birds come to an 11th floor?
I don't see any birds.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's ask Noel Cutright. Start with Noel.
It'd really be a challenge, I think, to be able to attract birds to that height, especially in an urban area. It might depend upon if you have a woods with some tall trees nearby, but at the 11th floor, that's pretty hard, pretty exposed. You're just not normally going to have birds searching for food at that kind of elevation in a highly urban environment. You might occasionally be able to attract a sparrow or something, but I think you got your chore cut out for you.
Okay. Yeah, and I assume, Bill, you agree with that.
Yeah, and you know, the problem is that birds fly at certainly a good height, 11 story, and certainly much higher than that, particularly in migration, but they tend to feed lower, and it's not just a habit of feeding down near the ground, but as Noel mentioned, you need some tall trees because it also has to be some close access to shelter. So they've got to come out for food and oftentimes find a safe place to retreat to quickly if danger should present itself. And that's, of course, important in anybody's backyard, is not just putting up feeders, but having some shelter for the birds. And that's going to be a challenge when you're that high up.
So I'm sorry to say, Al, you got a real challenge ahead of you there. But good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Glenda in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Glenda.
Hello.
What can
I have a question. When we built our house about 10 years ago, we put a 5.5-acre pond in the back of our house. And we're a couple of miles off the bay, so every year we got increasingly more and more migratory ducks and geese. And is it common to see a pair or two of canvasbacks mixed in with, like, the buffalo heads and that kind of thing? Or am I mistaking that for something else? Because it's not a red eye.
Could be canvasbacks. What do you think, Noel?
Sure. That's a fairly decent-sized pond. And we have the puddle ducks and the diving ducks. And the puddle ducks can spring right out of the water. They don't need any kind of takeoff area, whereas the diving ducks need to paddle across the water surface until they get airborne. But a 5.5-acre lake was certainly large enough to attract diving ducks. So, yeah, I would expect you'll get occasional bufflehead and redhead
canvasback. Yeah, we've had, like, maybe it started out with maybe 30 or 40, you know, ducks, and now it's, like, maybe 100 to 200.
We had
northern shovelers and...
Yeah.
You get lesser scaup and ring-necked duck, especially, one of your more common diving duck species.
We were fortunate this year to have a meganther have babies, which we've never seen before.
So you've got a great pond.
Oh, it's awesome. you would not believe I've taken so many pictures, including an eagle that had taken off a goose.
Oh, man.
And it was sitting on the side of the pond. So it's just awesome.
Well, thanks for calling, Glenn. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call. Ron and Mason, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. The first thing I want to stipulate is I was not out partying last night. So this is an earnest question. I had a dear friend of mine that lives in Mason here. We're right off Lake Superior. And she let out her Boston Terrier, 16 pounds plus. The tracks led to the middle of the yard after a fresh snow and was gone. Is there a bird of prey around here that would take something that big?
16 pounds?
16 pounds plus.
Oh, man. Bill, what do you think?
Well, you said fresh snow. You should be able to see evidence in the snow, whether that was a mammal or whether it was bird of prey. Coyotes certainly are out there, and, you know, small dogs and cats, they're open game for them. Great horned owl is going to be the largest of our predators, and you know, even for them, something like, say, a good-sized rabbit, they tend to decapitate it. It's not food for them, and it's excess weight. They have a hard time getting off the ground. Great horned owl has got a large wingspread, but the body of the bird only goes to maybe 3 pounds. So to take something that's 5 times your own weight and become airborne, that's going to be a real challenge. But I would think that, you say, fresh snow, you might have been able to see evidence of what the encounter was, whether the footprints of the dog ended with large wing prints in the snow or whether there were other footprints chasing it. But that, to me, to be able to actually lift off and take with that, because they'll take it to a killing perch and to feed off the ground where it's much safer for them, that's quite a wing loading.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Noel, you would agree as well.
Yes, I would. The only other species that will tackle something on the larger size, but they're, you know, quite uncommon in the state, are golden eagles. We certainly hear a lot and see a lot of bald eagles. That's the species that breeds here in the state. But in the wintertime especially, we're seeing, it appears, more golden eagles coming in and wintering in the state. And they will take a fairly large prey item also. I mean, they'll tackle, jackrabbits out west, newborn lambs and animals like that. So that might be another possibility, but again, they're quite uncommon. And whether there might be one in the Lake Superior area in the wintertime, it's possible.
Well, also, the Lake Superior shoreline is in large part heavily forested, and golden eagles tend to hunt in more of the open areas.
Correct.
So if you have just a small opening in a woodlot, it's not really typical habitat for them.
Yeah. So it's still a bit of a mystery, and I guess it's possible. If you saw the paw prints going out to the middle of the lawn and then disappear, I was going to say maybe the wind blew the tracks away, but you think
usually there's a story written in the snow, Larry. You're right on that. And that's oftentimes the best way to decipher that. It's also what we find is a way to learn a lot about mammals in Wisconsin, since most of them are nocturnal and quite secretive. It's the tracks that they leave in the snow is a good indicator both of their presence and their behavior, as well as, say, we use it within the department for our population estimates.
So, Maury, it's maybe a golden eagle, but otherwise it's a bit of a mystery.
Or coyote, I would say.
Or coyote. Maury in Port Washington is... Maury, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for calling.
Two questions about our large flock of turkeys. In the spring, we saw two appeared to be female turkeys leading baby chicks, about 20 or 25 baby chicks around the property in a long, long line. Our first question was, does the flock allow two, say, adult females to babysit for all the chicks? Because all these chicks couldn't have been hatched from just these two. That was one of our questions. And the other question has to do with the amount of food that they're scarfing up out here. And then after they leave, a single male comes by himself. Has he been ostracized from the flock?
Wow, that's let's start with Bill. Bill, go ahead.
Oh, good. That was a good question. First of all, turkeys tend to lay very large clutches of eggs, and this is typical of ground nesting birds. And I always explain this is because it is risky to lay your eggs on the ground, certainly more so than building a nest in a tree. And for a lot of these birds, from year to year, it's an all-or-nothing deal. So in other words, they tend to lay large clutches of eggs because quite often they may lose the entire clutch of eggs to a predator. But that 1 or 2 years out of their life, when they are successful, they can leave a lot of the young behind. So it's not unusual for turkeys to lay 12, 14, up to 16 eggs. Whether all of them hatch in any year, of course, is another matter, too.
A single bird, huh?
Yes. So a dozen for each may not be entirely out of the ordinary.
It's an amazing parade. Amazing.
Yes. And what they're doing is these birds were leading their young to where there's food. And the young ones primarily are eating insects when they're small. So crickets, grasshoppers is a big midsummer food for them. Mm-hmm. And so they don't really care about other families. They're not that territorial as long as there's a lot of food out there. And they will oftentimes congregate like that. The males were not, say, ostracized. And what happens here is those young are what we call precocial young. In other words, the day they hatch, they're fully feathered, get up, and within a few hours, they'll leave the nest, never come back, and now they're out searching for food. So in other words, the male has no real duty in feeding the young, unlike, say, robins, blue jays, and other songbirds, where the young are hatched out prematurely in a nest and require both parents to take care of them. The male, their big job, of course, is strutting out there, trying to get dominance in that flock for breeding, and after that, the female really raises a young. And that's more guardianship, that she's leading young to food and away from danger. The male just happened to come strutting by on his own after the fact, and he's just simply independent of those family groups at that time of year.
Now, it's the male now. The male now. Mm-hmm. The whole flock is quite large right now.
In wintertime, they will now congregate into these large flocks, and especially since we've had some pretty good snow on the ground, where there's food out in some of these fields, waste corn, spread manure, things like this are all available food, and those birds will be out there scratching and picking away. And again, they don't really care at this point of who else is joining them. And we'll oftentimes see some pretty good flocks out there. And we did our Christmas bird counts here at Horicon and the Kettle Marine in the last few weeks, and turkeys were quite noticeable. Sometimes just little groups of 4 to 6, sometimes some very large flocks that get out there.
And you'll sometimes see a deer right with the turkeys.
Yeah, they're out there, the same kind of food, sometimes during the day. And with a harsh winter like this, things are pressed to find food, so they'll spend a lot of time out in the open and during daylight hours to try to get maximum food because it's a long, cold night to get through from day to day.
Yeah, I live about 8 miles west of Port Washington, and 4 turkeys have found my feeder this winter. And the other day I came around the corner in the driveway and started to raise my garage door from inside the car, and the turkeys ran. I thought for a minute I was going to have a turkey in my garage because it went that direction, but just kind of veered off at the last minute.
And when they get frightened by a sudden noise, you're really afraid they're going to fly right straight into a tree and knock themselves out. We've had a few who just land in the trees and sit in the trees for a while. Is this typical?
Yes. That's where they roost at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. On to Jim in Iron County next. Jim, hello to you.
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks very much. We have a cabin that is sort of in the middle of the woods in Iron County. We are up here periodically. Sometimes there's just a week goes by. Sometimes up to a month or a month and a half goes by before we get up here. And curious to know whether or not you know of anything that would be a large capacity automatic feeder. We've got bird feeders out everywhere, and oftentimes the feed runs out, usually sunflower seed runs out before we get back up here, and it takes a while for the birds to find us again. Wonder if there's something that's available, sort of like game feeders, which I believe are illegal to use in Wisconsin, that would be appropriate to maintain that supply of sunflower seeds while we're gone.
I don't know. Noel, do you know of any?
I know there are some feeders on the market that will hold something like 5 gallons of food. I think there are other feeders specifically designed for turkey. Bill, do you know specifically?
I've seen some designs out there. I haven't actually seen the models. And probably what you're referring to are some of these have got like a large bucket or tub on top where it's gravity-fed and then sort of a feeding tray around the outside so you can put a pretty good capacity of food in there. That might be the best. Keep in mind, though, the baiting and feeding laws these days, and they are changing as well. So with that, you may have to confine that as well so it doesn't become a deer feeding station or something of the sort. That's probably the best. The last thing I guess I would keep in mind is it's nice to lure the birds into your bird feeders, and it's great for us. And when, you know, the birds certainly do take advantage of it during emergencies, but there's a lot of natural food that they always have taken advantage of, and it seems like still the large majority of their diet comes from nature. So don't think that they're going to die of starvation if you're not feeding them. It's certainly nice to bring them in, and it's fast food and convenient food for the birds and can help in emergencies, as I said.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this first day of 2009, we're taking a look at resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin with Noel Cutright, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management out of Horicon Marsh. Glad to have them along, and thank you for listening. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we have some open lines. Get you on pretty fast. Tim in Manitouish Waters is up next. Tim, hello to you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, gentlemen, and happy bird feeding, everybody. Quick question. They're about 8 feet away. There's 30 to 40 of them at my bird feeder, and I solely am giving them sunflower seeds. They're all maybe just a tad smaller than a sparrow. They're a dirty lime green, and their wings are black with yellow stripes.
Wow. No. Noel, what do you think?
Were you out partying last night, Tim?
No, I was asleep by 10, but I happened to wake up at 3 minutes to midnight. Neither here nor there. I'm looking at them right now, and they're a dirty green or a lime green.
Sounds like winter goldfinch.
That's what it is, then. See, I got the big book from the library, and so many birds are close, but I'm sure that's what they are. I just wanted to clarify my thought.
Yeah, that color, as you describe, sort of olive green, lime, well, not really quite bright lime green, but some people, I get this question a lot, and I'm sure Noel does, as many others will. we recognize that goldfinch for its brilliant summer colors, but they go through such a transformation for winter, it looks like a completely different bird.
And that's what I was thinking, that was their winter plumage that could throw me off in trying to ID
them. Look at the bill. It's a little conical-shaped bill for cracking seeds. The tail will be notched, so it'll be a little like a fork on each side.
Perfect.
And slightly
are you sure
pinkish
you're not
to the bill.
On my roof?
Dibson, are you sure you're not sitting on my roof there, Bill?
It's such a common bird, and it can throw you incredibly. And I hear this also from people say, well, where do all those goldfinches go that we have in summertime? They just change so much, you'd hardly recognize them.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, I have an interesting tidbit to add about the large bird feeder.
Yeah.
There is now a bird feeder that's been accepted by the Guinness Book of World Records for the largest bird feeder. And it contains around 130 pounds of bird food. A person built it and applied to Guinness, and it took them about a year, and they finally accepted it as the bird feeder holding the largest volume of bird seed, around between 125 and 135 pounds of sunflower seed.
Sounds like a garbage can with a little tray underneath for the seed to drop into.
This guy, it shows him filling, and he's up on a ladder, pouring it in at the top.
He's only going to buy his bird seed once a year, fill it up, and last until spring, huh?
Oh, man.
Wow.
So if you want to go after a record out, guys out there, go for 150 pounds and apply to Guinness.
Oh, boy. Thanks again for calling, Tim. Terry in Green Bay will go to you next. Hi, Terry.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I have one question. Actually, I have one question, two comments. With the golden eagles, what is their territory? And the comments are birds need water in the wintertime. And the other comment is I saw a bald eagle chasing a goose.
Yeah.
So who do you think won? And I'll take my answer off to here.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Well, let's see. Let's start with Noel. Noel?
You asked about golden eagles first. I guess I brought up the topic. Golden eagles, as I mentioned, it seems like we're establishing a larger winter population in the western part of the state. Christmas bird counts and the great backyard bird count, they actually have an eagle count kind of targeting golden eagles in the western part of the state. Buffalo County kind of comes to mind, down in Monroe County, over into the Nisida area, and of course then over into Minnesota. So we're seeing more and more golden eagles here in Wisconsin. At one time, we thought that, well, golden eagles are only found in the western U.S. Now we're finding that they're also coming down into the East Coast. My son was at Cape May, New Jersey, as a hawk watcher this fall, and they had one day where they had about a half a dozen golden eagles, and these birds are breeding up in the Labrador Peninsula. So we're seeing more and more golden eagles migrating through the eastern and Midwest and now overwintering in Wisconsin, but, you know, still a very uncommon species. You ask about water. Yes, birds do need water. I keep an open bird bath, heated bird bath, available for them all winter. And we've already talked about bald eagles taking geese.
Yeah, absolutely. They will take a goose. I've actually seen that.
And half of it is either they get lucky or here at Horicon Marsh, a lot of times those are the cripples or those that have been injured in one way or another. So a good, healthy goose is going to be a tough, somewhat formidable prey. But, they will take them if they can get them.
Karen in Bailey's Harbor, on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Had a question. We're new to the Bailey's Harbor area, and we have a house very near the water, and we'd like to start feeding birds. What would you recommend as a good seed or feed to attract a broad array of birds or combination of two or three types of feed? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Noel, we'll start with you.
Well, there's five feeds that come to my mind if you're going to go to a variety. Black oil sunflower is probably the finest single seed that you can have to attract a wide variety of birds. You know, corn is kind of the old standby, is crack corn. It's probably fed on by more species, but it's really not a preferred food of most any species. So that's kind of a last choice. Suet is wonderful to have. If you can find the unprocessed suet at a good meat market or a butcher shop, this is the big hunk of fat that hangs around the kidney. You know, it's high energy. Woodpeckers love it.
also nuthatches and chickadees. Thistle or Niger seed, it's really a member of the sunflower family. It's called thistle seed. It's pretty expensive, but it's great for attracting American goldfinches and pine siskins. Last year, red poles came to it extensively. You feed it in a tube-type feeder. And finally, for the ground nest or ground feeding birds like American tree sparrows, which are really quite abundant this winter, we're having a really wonderful year for tree sparrows, and also Junco's white millet is probably the preferred food.
So there you have it. Would you add anything, Bill?
No, I think you pretty well covered it. And I always tell people for a variety of birds, a variety of food, and also, as Noel indicated, a variety of feeders or feeding strategies, a little bit on the ground or what spills out, as well as the different types of feeders to hold the various kinds of food out there. That works well. The last thing I would add is, as I said before, and I can't stress it enough, look at your landscaping, make sure there's shelter, and if you don't have it now, plan for spring and try to look at your landscaping, see what you can do to add that other important component.
Yeah, they need to have a place to go.
It's the food, water, shelter. Those are the three things. Everybody should know that.
Cindy in Bayfield County, we're on to you now.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Well, we have always had flocks and flocks of evening grosbeaks at our feeders at the cottage, and the last couple of years they seem to have basically vanished, and we wondered if something has happened that's caused that.
All right, evening grosbeaks. Noel, what about evening grosbeaks in the Bayfield County area?
Well, your experience, what many other people in Wisconsin have experienced over the last couple of decades, the populations of evening grosbeaks here in the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes states have declined significantly over the last couple of decades. You know, it was not uncommon to have good numbers of grosbeaks all the way down into the middle part of the state, you know, Stevens Point, Wausau, but even farther down in the state here in the southeastern part of the state. But the population is declining. They're not declining throughout their range. Out in the Pacific Northwest, grosbeaks still seem to be doing well. But here in the eastern U.S. and in the central states, evening grosbeaks are declining in the wintertime, and it's getting to the point where you really have to look for evening grosbeaks hard to be able to find any if you want to see them every year. So what you're experiencing has been experienced with a lot of folks, and where it's all going to go, I guess that's one of the reasons we do all these studies like Christmas bird counts and great backyard bird counts, even the breeding bird surveys, to try to track populations of species. And once we know that there is something that's happening to cause a decline, we can address that from a land management or address the cause. But with evening grosbeaks, it's difficult to know at this point what is causing the decline.
Thank you again for calling. Mike in Seneca, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Thank you, Larry. I didn't get on last month, and I had this question. I have a lot of woodpeckers out here.
Yes.
And last year I had a pair that, if I could replicate this sound, but this year the same birds, I don't know if they're the same pair, but they look alike from last year. They don't make that sound anymore. They just kind of go, when they're anticipating flying down to the feeder or see somebody, they kind of go, chip, 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 chip. But last year they went kind of like that. Did you hear that?
Did you hear that, Bill?
Yeah.
Like that sound.
Okay. Woodpeckers are not real vocal. In other words, they don't really sing overall. The flicker will make certainly quite more of a cackle during the mating season, but the drumming that you hear from woodpeckers is instead of a song. This is in springtime. That's happening. And you'll hear as the days get longer now, in mid-late January already, the downy woodpeckers will start doing a little more tapping out there and starting to at least warm up for eventually establishing a territory. The calls that we hear are contact calls, warning calls, and so forth. I think what you're indicating is a red-bellied woodpecker, if I can kind of hear at least the rhythm in there. And they tend to make a very typical little three-note, kind of like a chuck, chuck, chuck. And then they'll do a little bit more of, as you indicated here, this longer rolling call. Downy and hairy woodpecker, just a simple peep, and then that longer call of their warning call that we'll hear from either of those. But overall, there's not a lot of variation. One thing I was surprised, we did just last weekend the Northern Kettle Moraine Forest count, and Noel helped us on that one. I couldn't believe all the flickers I had on my counts. It's a bird that's not that often seen in the Christmas bird counts. So most of those migrate. But I had an outstanding 15 flickers with one flock of seven of them. Why they were sticking around this year in that number, at least in my count area, was is beyond me. But they tend to be a little more vocal than the others, but not a common winter bird. So woodpecker calls, they're not that hard to learn because they don't have so much variation. They don't have a big repertoire.
Interesting. And thank you very much for calling, Mike. Appreciate your call. We're talking resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin with our two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at our resident and migrant birds here in the state with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, DNR wildlife educator and naturalist who's working out of Horicon Marsh. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And we got an email from Dave in the town of Springfield, who, and this is probably for Bill here, can you mention the best time of year to visit Horicon to see the wonderful variety of birds?
Well, any time of year, there's always going to be something, but if you're really looking for the peak, mid-April to about the middle end of May is a great time, certainly for the songbirds. You want to get here in May before the leaves are completely out. We may still have a lot of migrant birds and resident birds here at that time, but they become increasingly more difficult to find little songbirds. And in the second weekend of May is always the Horicon Marsh Bird Festival. If anybody's looking ahead for that, you can just go to HoriconMarshBirdFestival.com, and the whole spring schedule will be on there. Otherwise, traditionally fall time, and here we're seeing mostly that period of early mid-September through the end of October. And during those migration periods, the variety of birds that are going to be present here at the marsh or anywhere else can change just about every 10 days. So, you know, people say, I commonly get the question, what is the peak of migration during either spring or fall? Well, I'd have to answer that with the peak of what, because that's always changing. And, you know, somewhere in there, you're going to get the peak of something. But during the early mid-May, when we hold our bird festival, we have sort of the last of the migrant waterfowl still present, and we're getting toward the peak of the songbird migration. It's a great mix. But any time from, say, mid-April, the end of May, and mid-September through the end of October, those tend to be the real peaks for a variety of birds.
Well, let's turn to Betty in Lime Ridge next. Betty, hello. Thank you for waiting.
Well, good morning. Happy New Year.
To you, too.
I'm thoroughly enjoying this program. I got to tell you an experience that I had. I have this young hawk. Well, it started a couple years back, and he's just kind of hanging around the area. So anytime he came out here, I would chase him away. I have lots of bird feeders. My house is sitting up high, so I can look down at the feeders. And the crazy bird would give a call before he came in, so I knew he was on his way. Well, one day I didn't. I just stood here and I watched. And you know that stinker? The birds flew away. They went into this little evergreen tree that I have here. And the hawk flew around that tree and took his wingtips and hit at the branches.
Ah.
Around the tree went two, three times. Finally, he flushed a bird out. It was a cardinal. And bango, he had it. I figured, well, that's the way life is, you know. It was just very, very interesting to see this. I thought, what?
What kind of hawk was that? I bet your question is, eh?
Well, yeah. I'm right at the edge of a woods.
Okay.
And,
well, let's see what Noel has to say. Noel?
Well, I think my response is going to be similar to what it was before. It was probably a Cooper's hawk. They will learn to walk in under shrubs and so forth, try to flush birds out. They will fly into a shrub or a small tree or try to roust the birds in some fashion so they can catch them on the wing. As Bill mentioned, they have long tails, which make them very maneuverable. They have short, rounded wings, which really helps also in pursuing birds on the wing. So I'm guessing with some certainty it was probably a Cooper's hawk.
All right. So there you have it, Betty.
Amazes me how fast they can go between the branches without knocking themselves out. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. Thank you very much for calling. Nancy in Waukesha, we're on to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've always wondered about this in my 40 years of bird watching here in my oak woods. Does the male impregnate the female first, and then either she or they build a nest, or is it the other way around? Is the nest built first, and then the impregnation?
Bill?
Usually the mating will take place either prior to or during nest building, and it all depends on the species. So, for example, orrens, the male will typically build a variety of nests, and then call in a female during somewhere in that process, lure her in, the mating will take place, and then she'll finally select which of the nests she really likes. And oftentimes mating continues throughout some of that early nest building, egg laying period. So it's not always a single mating for them. And each of the different species of birds oftentimes have different strategies, too. But usually it'll take place just prior to or during early nest construction. And it depends if they both work on the nest or if the male will build the nest and then lure the female. Every bird has a different strategy to try to raise young.
Okay, thank you. I've always wondered about this.
All right.
Thanks for asking.
Thanks, Nancy. Bill and DePere, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had large numbers of goldfinches around, and now they seem to have suddenly just totally disappeared. Two questions. First, where have they gone? And second, do birds move out of Wisconsin depending upon how much stress there is in the winter? And, of course, here this year there's a whole lot of stress.
All right. Noel?
Well, goldfinches are somewhat nomadic. They will move around a lot. So maybe you have a neighbor is offering a better feeding situation, and maybe they've moved there. It's hard to explain the comings and goings around bird feeders from day to day to week to week, season to season. But goldfinches and the finches in general tend to move around quite a lot from one location to another. And it's hard to know why all of a sudden you've had goldfinches, why they disappear. They found a different feeding source. Maybe they're being harassed by Cooper's hawks too much, and they've learned that there's a safer location to go. So it's kind of hard to determine.
You know, if I might add something, a number of years ago, I was catching and marking goldfinches at my bird feeders. I'm a licensed bird bander. And what I noticed is that as I caught a group of birds, I would see them return to the feeder for several days. Sometimes a few individuals might stick around for a week or more. And yet, when I looked at my feeders through the wintertime, it appeared to me as if I had a flock of 10, 12, 15 goldfinches every day. But if I were to catch and mark them, what I noticed is a flock of 10 or 15 would come in, visit that feeder, hit it hard for a while, they would leave and be replaced by another flock.
Oh.
So as Noel indicated, being wanderers, I thought about this for a while, and you know, goldfinches are seed eaters, which is why we can bring them into our bird feeders, and yet in nature, that food is finite. They find a nice little stand of, say, a woodland sunflower, pound that food, and they realize there's not going to be another fresh crop until next year. And so they will hit that hard and always be forced by nature to move on and, in a sense, have never quite caught on or been able to adapt to the idea that we fill that feeder every single day. So nature keeps them on the move. And yet, you know, your flock, they picked up and it just meant another flock hasn't yet replaced them.
No.
They're nomads.
Yet I have one other question. I live right by a small river with woods, and the owls are just going wild with their calls. I just wonder, when do they mate and hatch?
All right. Noel, you want to take that?
Well, great horned owls are starting to think about that right now. In fact, some of your listeners may remember last year we had a great horned owl taking up residence in a peregrine falcon nesting box at the Oak Creek Power Plant in southern Milwaukee County. Well, the webcam shows that great or a great horned owl is back, and the way she appeared in the camera the other day, she might be actually in the process of laying an egg now. So here we are into the new year, January. Great horned owls are our earliest nesting species, so we may have some that are thinking about it, or maybe they've even gone to the point of starting a nest already and laying eggs. Some of the other owl species are a little bit later into the later winter and early spring. So again, we, as with many birds, as Bill's talked about, each species has their own particular life history that they pursue, with great horned owls being the earliest nester, other owls nesting later into the late winter, early spring.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Bill. And Jack in Boston, it's your turn. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good.
I've got two questions, actually. One is about an unidentified bird. This was like last May 10th. It was a Saturday morning. It was drizzling. In the backyard, there was a bird. It kind of looked like a cowbird. It was very dark gray, maybe darker gray on the top than on its belly. But it had twin crown or crest stripes and twin eye stripes also. And it was tugging on a night crawler, and it was about the size of a blackbird or a cowbird. I've looked through just about every book that I've got, and
Bill, what do you think?
Well, the first thing that went through my mind was white crown sparrow. They're not quite as deep gray as a cowbird, maybe not quite as big, but they're one of the larger sparrows. A very uniform slate gray breast, a pink bill, and that very pronounced striping of black and white across the head and just above the eye. Take a look in the book to see if that's maybe it. I don't know if Noel's got something else that he's got rolling through his head.
That's what came into my head also, Bill, was a white crown sparrow. They're a migrant. May 10th would be the probably right around the peak of their migration, so at least that would be my first shot at it.
Okay, I've got my book out here. The other question is, we live right on the Lemonwire River here, and because our yard gently slopes into the river, we get normally about 10 pair of geese and their goslings coming up on the yard to eat the grass. And I know geese usually have like 8 to 12, goslings, but this one pair ended up stealing, and geese protect. You see them chasing the other geese away from their goslings when they get near there. But we had one pair that ended up with 34 goslings.
Bill?
That's an interesting phenomenon, what we call gang broods. And actually, geese tend to lay about 3 to 5 eggs. 7 would be about maximum. So what you have is already a bird that's adopted young from others. We don't know the entire mechanics, because I've always been interested of capturing enough of these birds, marking them of known ages to see what happens. But here's my guess. The younger first-time nesting birds, and geese don't nest until they're about 3 to 4 years old, those birds that have never been parents before, I don't know if, with the lack of experience, if they're that watchful. Yes, you mentioned that they are quite protective and territorial, but the young ones, they go through the motions. All of a sudden, they've got a family, and I don't know if they always know what to do with it. And I think they readily give up those young by just being unattentive or careless to the older, more experienced birds. And those are the ones that adopt the larger flock. Like we mentioned earlier about turkeys, the geese have precocial young. So the parents really aren't feeding the young. It's just guardianship. And it's kind of like running a daycare center. All of a sudden, you've got a good, experienced, watchful pair that end up with everybody else's. And it's not that they're trying to round them up, but they imprint on any other goose. And if the parents aren't that watchful and probably lacking experience, those birds are rounded up by the older birds. Next thing you know, they've got everybody in the neighborhood tailing behind them. I get that question every year. How many eggs do they lay? I had one the other day with 25 with it. What's going on? Well, they can't incubate that many. So 5 to 7 eggs would be about maximum for a goose, but these are gang broods, as they've been called.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for calling.
Larry, before we take another call, can I bring up something here?
Yeah, you bet.
There's a new publication. We've had quite a lot of questions today about people wanting to know what they can do for birds, feeders, landscaping, whatever. There's a new publication out. It's put out by Birds Without Borders. This is a project that the Zoological Society of Milwaukee has been sponsoring for about a decade. And they have a brand new publication came out late last year, 2008, called How to Manage Your Land to Help Birds. And people can download it off their website. It's about 150 pages, very attractive, a lot of color in the publication. And you can go to the Zoological Society's website, www.zoosociety.org. click on conservation, and it'll take you there, or just do a search, Birds Without Borders, and that website should come up, and you can see this landowner guide. They also produce one for Belize, because they have done a project here in Wisconsin as well as Belize, and they have information for landowners in both of these countries or areas, Wisconsin and Belize, on what landowners can do to how to manage their land to help the birds.
So that's go to zoosociety.org.
Right, and then /conservation and click, and you'll go right to, and be able to find this guide there.
Oh, excellent. Well, you know, you did a good job of promoting a book last time you were on, Noel. It was Robbins. I'm trying to remember the name. Robbins.
Like All of This and Robbins,
yeah,
Too,
all
by
of
Steve
this.
Bechtel. And you had him on as,
yes,
as a guest, and boy, he did a wonderful job. And you had some great callers that day.
Oh, yeah. It was a very good show, and a lot of people contacted him about that book. So hopefully we'll get a lot of people going to that zoosociety.org/conservation and get a copy of How to Manage Your Land for Birds.
Yeah, Vicki Piazakowski did a lot of bird banding in both countries and here in Wisconsin, different locations. And in fact, this coming Tuesday, she'll be at the River Edge Bird Club giving a program on this topic, and people that attend this, it's a free program at the River Edge Bird Club at 7 p.m. I'm sure she'll bring copies of this publication along to anyone that attends that program.
Larry in Waupaca has a question for you guys, so let's go to Larry. Hi, Larry.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple years ago, it was probably late September, early October, it was on Trout Lake up by Boulder Junction. I witnessed a group of loons, a huge group of loons on a lake, and I've always seen loons in the past, but there have always been solitary one or two birds. But there had to be 50, maybe 70 birds in this group on the water, and it was late in the day, and they were all calling. It was an incredible experience. I'm sure it has something to do with the migration that time of the year. So I'm just looking for some information related to that. Why do they group up in such large numbers at that time of the year?
Sure.
I'll take my response off the air.
All right, thanks. Bill, comment from you.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds like migration because loons are highly territorial, and loons, of course, are nesting across northern Wisconsin and throughout Canada. So when these birds start coming down, we can oftentimes see some unusually large concentration on some of these lakes. And also we'll see them in southern Wisconsin on lakes where they normally don't appear as they're coming through. The loon, while we think of it as a bird of the far north, in the late 1800s used to nest throughout southern Wisconsin and even around the lakes of northern Illinois. It's just been changes to the shoreline habitat that we've pushed them out. But on these southern lakes, we will see them in migration, and you just happen to catch a very unique phenomenon where it looks like a large number bailed out of Canada and other areas and just gathered on that lake for a few days. And it must have been quite a little party with them whooping it up out there, and an incredible sight and experience. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely. We had an email from Claudia in Madison, wonders, can you recommend a bird book that not only describes Wisconsin birds and their region of habitat, but also shows a picture of their nest and explains dates of nesting, migrations, and what they eat? Noel?
Boy, there are specific field guides that have just nests, but a bird book that has all the other information she's wanting, plus a picture of the nest. I'm not sure off the top of my head. I can't think of one.
I would say buy more than one. Good
right.
Identification books are certainly out there. There's a whole variety. The New Peterson has been updated, and a Sibley book, a variety of those, National Geographic. They're out there for identification, mm-hmm. Two of them for nests. In the Peterson series, there is one by Harrison on nests of North American birds, and another one by Colin Harris. I think he's a British author, put one out on birds of North America, their nests, eggs, and so forth. And those are both really good guides, and they give a picture of the nest, the eggs, give a description of incubation time, common nest structure, the types of materials they use, the average height where they tend to build those. And so that can help you quite a bit, but you'll need more than one book.
All right. Let's go to Mary in Lafarge. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Happy New Year to everybody.
To you as well.
I'm on a nice Vernon ridgetop covered in snow. In fact, I'm snowed in, but that's fine, too. But on November 28th, I saw a northern harrier, male. I looked it up, and it was close enough and flying so low that it was easy to identify.
you know, has the owl-like eye discs or face discs.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered how common they are. I know they used to be called marsh hawks because that's usually where they are, but this is a ridgetop. So.
Yeah. All right. Noel?
They're not an uncommon species in Wisconsin. They're throughout in Wisconsin in low numbers. As you mentioned, their old name, marsh hawk, that this represents the areas where they typically breed in low wet meadows or marshes of certain kinds. This winter, they've been quite uncommon. That's because of the early snows that we had. Since they're looking for primarily meadow voles in fields, they forage back and forth, fly back and forth across these fields looking for a meadow vole. But the deeper snows really drove them south of Wisconsin this winter. In fact, I haven't seen one on any of the Christmas bird counts that I've done over the last couple of weeks, and I've seen very few reported. But still in late November, they're definitely going to be found. And again, some winters we find them quite commonly, and as I mentioned, they also do breed in Wisconsin. But not a common bird, but again, not a real uncommon bird either.
Chad in Johnson Creek emailed us and wondered, he's got a finch feeder out there with Niger seed in it, but just can't seem to get any finches to come to it. He wonders about how to attract them, and you know, habitat near is probably important, but what else?
Well, certainly, yeah, shelter nearby so the birds feel safe in approaching it, and as we mentioned earlier, those finches are wanderers, and so sometimes it's just a matter of waiting for that next flock to come in. And we'll hear from people, as we perhaps have had in past programs as well. Somebody's just got an incredible flock of finches. Somebody else is waiting for them to show up. And as we mentioned earlier, some of the other finches, besides goldfinches, the siskins and so forth, are migrants from up north, and they're not always here in big numbers. So every so often when the food crop in Canada crashes, we get an influx. So those birds will come and go from year to year. I'd say just give it time.
All right. And Ruth, have you got a quick question? Hi.
Hi. I mentioned to your answer about the pine siskins I'm having here along with the goldfinches this for the past 3 years. And the other thing that I wanted to ask you was I have some of the old college woods back here, a section. We used to see red-headed woodpeckers in the summer, spring, fall. Not for 5 years.
Not for 5 years. So what do you think, Bill?
Red-headed woodpeckers are birds that have declined significantly throughout Wisconsin, throughout many of the north central states. It's a bird that has lost out an awful lot, and we just don't see what we used to. Southwest and west central Wisconsin still has a fair population, and there are some management recommendations in larger woodlot, more savanna areas to try to help that bird out. But it is a bird of concern, definitely.
Well, guys, thank you so much for being with us again, once again on holidays, and Noel and Bill, and we'll certainly look forward to your next visit. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks so much for having us. Every holiday is a great way to start out the year, and I hope people are watching birds the rest of the year as well.
Happy New Year to you both. And thank you all for listening. Boy, it's been a great show. Just tomorrow, we've got Lisa Johnson coming in for another edition of Garden Talk. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.